Welcome to Race and Reason in Atlanta from Toronto, Canada. Today, my guest is Eric Thompson. Eric, you are going to explain to us the differences between National Socialism, Fascism, and Communism.
And Communism, yes. There seems to be a great deal of confusion purposely sown by our enemies about the relationship between National Socialism, Fascism, and Communism. I remember as a younger person reading some of the Hearst newspapers in which they were talking about red fascism. Now that's a very funny thing, because red means communist, and communists are internationalists, and fascists are nationalists. So here he's condemning international nationalism, which is a total contradiction in terms, totally illogical, total nonsense, and unfortunately many people, especially in the right wing, tend to confuse National Socialism, Fascism, and Communism. Well, let's look at Communism. As one professor said, all revolutions are conservative. Well, Communism, as a revolutionary force, is the most conservative movement in the world. They wish to return to a state of nature, which they call the Garden of Eden. It's been referred to the time when there was no social institutions at all. It is called anarchy, where there's no government, no family, no churches, no schools, no factories, no work. And somehow out of all of this, people are supposed to receive according to their needs. Now, nobody's ever proved that such a state of nature ever existed in regard to man on planet Earth. Anthropologists have gone all over the planet looking for the noble savage who has intelligence like Tarzan and lives this state of nature life where everyone is equal and everyone receives according to his needs. And they still haven't found it. What they've found is people who live in little grass huts with loincloths, and these people have as many social institutions, as many hang-ups, as many taboos and customs as any of us. In fact, they probably have even more. They worry about things that we wouldn't even think of worrying about. So the communists want to return to an idealized but totally unrealistic state of nature. They believe, of course, what you all know, because you hear communist propaganda in all of your media of information, entertainment, and education. We all hear about equality. Well, communists are first and foremost equalitarians. They believe that everybody is equal, and if they aren't, they should be made equal. So, the communists are internationalists. They believe that all featherless bipeds, also called human beings on this earth, are equal. If they're not, they should be made to be equal. That blacks should be made to behave exactly like whites, or vice versa, and you should have one big, supposedly happy family, everybody coffee-colored, and nobody wanting too much, and everybody getting exactly what they want, with no means of state intervention, no coercion, no institutions, no jails, of course, no hospitals, no families. So, this is theoretically what communism is all about. It's internationalism because it believes in one world government, and it believes it's conservative because it wishes to return to an imaginary state of nature that existed before history. Now, let's look at fascism. Fascism was first enunciated by Mussolini. Mussolini was a socialist, and he saw that socialism failed in World War I, as it's failing today, because people do not identify as a class. In other words, Italians of the working class saw themselves as Italians, Germans of the working class saw themselves as Germans, French of the working class saw themselves as French and British and so on and so forth. Nobody saw themselves as international workers of the world, and consequently World War I came about precisely because the socialists have failed. Now, these failures are the very people who are running Europe today. And how they have been allowed to take over Europe is a sad testament to the mental and moral bankruptcy of the people. living on the continent, that they would permit such a bunch of has-beens and failures to rule when they couldn't even stop World War I. Now, Mussolini had been a socialist. In fact, his name Benito came from the Benito Juarez, who was viewed as a very liberal, semi-socialist leader of Mexico, who fought the Emperor Maximilian.
Right.
Now, Mussolini said, let's get back to brass tacks. What is reality here? Internationalism doesn't work. Class solidarity doesn't work. We have Italy, which is made up of classes. It's made up of different interest groups. Well, let's look at the legitimate interest groups and let us bring them to the council table.
Plus the powerful church.
The church was an interest group, right. Yes. You had big landowners, you had the army, you had the nobility, you had industrialists, you had the labor unions, you had the little farmers, you had the peasants, you had unemployed people. And Italy was virtually ungovernable, and it's becoming ungovernable today. So what did Mussolini see? He looked at it, he said, we're all Italians, we're not really internationalists, we can't be, that's a flop, so we don't need to worry about that. Let's look at the problems of Italy. So he looked at the problems of Italy. There were strikes, there was low pay, there was unrest. The country was just divided against itself. So he said, all right, all you people who have anything to say, you, the Pope, you, the head industrialist, you, the big banker, you, the peasant leader, you, the labor union fellow, you all come to the council table. And let's work out a modus operandi, an agreement in which we can coexist. And the reason Mussolini saw for the harmonizing of this group of competing power blocks within the society was the preservation and the aggrandizement of the state. Fascism is primarily statism. It is a type of nationalism. Mussolini wanted to recall the grandeur of the Roman Empire, and hence his colonial conquest to try to retake the empire. However, I've read fascist literature and fascist propaganda, and I have seen that the fascists were not racists.
True.
Now, here's where the communists right. get it all wrong.
Right.
If you were a black Ethiopian, you could join the Italian colonial forces. In fact, you could even dress up in a fascist uniform. I've seen the pictures of these converted or colonized blacks and Arabs. And if you were willing to support the interests of the Italian state, you could be a fascist yourself. Now, that comes to National Socialism. The difference between National Socialism and fascism is that National Socialism is racist. Fascism is statist. Communism is really a non-starter because it's anarchist. So it wants to get rid of all ideas of state. Now, National Socialism has been mistaken. Again, many Americans, myself included, were roped into this idea that socialism equals communism. Well, communism is a form of socialism. Just as capitalism, if you look at it, is a way of ordering the priorities of a society. In other words, a society means social, and any study of society is sociology. It doesn't have to be left-wing. It can be monarchist, it can be capitalist, it can be any theocratic, but the socialism of National Socialism was not communism by any means. And Hitler combined the two major movements. Hitler was a realist, like Mussolini. He combined the two major movements in Germany. One was nationalism, one was socialism. The communists were the third runners. And of course, they were the nastiest because they couldn't stand to see their program demolished, which it was, by popular consent of the German people. The Germans just didn't want to have anything to do with communism. They'd experienced a whiff of it in 1918, and they'd experienced the Jews who ran it. They didn't like them. And so communism was a non-starter. The socialists, however, were very powerful with the labor unions in Germany, and the nationalists were very powerful too. So Hitler said, why are these two groups of Germans fighting one another? National socialism is the vessel which protects the race. In other words, the state is subordinate to the race at all times in National Socialism, and that's the primary difference. The communists and the socialists made another big blunder. They, assuming that all men were equal, they got rid of managers, managerial brains. They created a scarcity in Soviet Russia. The Khazar conquerors of Russia massacred anyone who didn't have calloused hands and who was found wandering around in Russia. They just put him up against the wall, if he was a Gentile, and they shot him.
When you say Khazar, Eric, explain to the people, you mean the Jewish Bolsheviks of 1917
yes.
who started the revolution?
Yes, okay. the Khazar, you see, the Russian people have never been self-governing. They've either been ruled by Tartars, they've been ruled by Mongols, they've been ruled by Swedes, they've been ruled by, the last one was Germanic, the Romanov family was related to Queen Victoria and the Kaiser of Germany. So the Khazar nation, which is primarily, they call themselves Jews, and basically Judaism is simply another smokescreen for the advancement of their national interests. The Khazars come from the area around the Black Sea into Georgia, and this area was known as the Pale of Settlement under the Tsar, because these people who had converted to Judaism in 700 AD approximately, under King Bulan of Khazaria, they were so ungovernable, so predacious, that they could not actually commingle with the Christian and non-Khazar population without those people suffering severe damage, as we see today. So the problem is, when the Khazar nation conquered Russia in 1917 and converted that land territory to their use, they then advanced their world power under the guise of communism. And it's a very interesting thing that eyewitnesses on the spots in the United States witnessed a major stampede of Gentiles from the Communist Party in the 1930s, who had been communists and pro-communists in the 1930s. They literally stampeded out when the Hitler-Stalin Pact was signed.
Right.
Because that was just one too many flip-flops of ideology for them. And so National Socialism was opposed to this corrosive, downbreeding effect of communism.
Explain to the people that the National Socialists, i.e. National Racialism, that there was private enterprise, there was a stock market in there,
that's
if you had less than three Jewish grandparents and didn't consider yourself a Jew, you weren't called a Jew, that there were literally hundreds of thousands of half and quarter Jews in Nazi Germany.
That's right.
Served in the Luftwaffe, the Wehrmacht, the Hitler Youth.
That's right.
And this is one thing that the Zionist Jewish group try to say, that, well, if you had one drop of Jewish blood, which I was told 20 years ago, then you were slaughtered. Well, this is total nonsense.
Well, one of the big questions in National Socialism was what is a Jew, if anything?
Right.
There are people who are Khazars, and they claim to be Jews, and yet they're atheists. We have Khazars coming up to Toronto to visit Samizdat Publishers, because Samizdat is a Russian word. And when they meet Mr. Zundel in the office and they say, I'm a Jew, Mr. Zundel says, oh, you are. And then they immediately say they're communists and they're atheists. Now, how can you be an atheist and say that you're a Presbyterian or you're a Catholic or something? You can't. So obviously they're using the word Jew in a totally different way than we would use it as a religion. So it must not be a religion. And then they say, yes, well, anybody who is of our blood is a Jew, whether he is circumcised, whether he is has been bar mitzvahed or any has even opened the Bible. He's considered to be a Jew. And it's interesting, the Orthodox rabbinate in Israel, as I understand, considers such people who are atheists to be Jews.
True, I've read that.
And yet they don't accept converts who have studied Judaism as on par with these Jews. So what we're seeing here is Khazar nationalism.
All right, now, also explain to the people the how private enterprise existed and grew in Nazi Germany.
Yes. Well, one of the things which the socialists and the communists have always tried to do is to get people to work for nothing, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, as Karl Marx enunciated in the Communist Manifesto. The problem with that is that most people need an incentive to do anything, and I don't see why they shouldn't be paid for their work. And so the National Socialist government encouraged people to accumulate property. They did not tax people. They did not discourage enterprise. Alfred Krupp was allowed to run the Krupp Industries as long as he didn't use it to sabotage the German national interest. And consequently, by keeping the brain power, which the socialists and the communists had killed in their various attempts to revolution, by keeping the brain power in place, the managerial ability, which is very scarce at all times in any society, the National Socialists were able to make great gains in progress once they had freed Germany from the domination of the Jew, the international finance Jews. Now, getting back to the subject of race, you raise a very important point. What was a Jew? In National Socialist Germany, they were reaching an accord with the territorial Zionists to determine who was a Jew. If a man had been a Christian for a great length of time, and he considered himself a German, and his parents were of the same persuasion, were they really Jews or not? In fact, the Jews, not being a race, you could say the Khazars are indeed a race, but the Jews, per se, are not a race. So what we're dealing with here is primarily an ideology that certain people who have certain biological characteristics may or may not adopt as a religion, and the Jews themselves in Israel have not agreed to this day on what constitutes a Jew.
Well, from a nationalistic point of view, in the sense of a Jew, they are prone to so many genetic diseases. That's why there's seven specific Jewish genetic diseases that
well,
they
that's
are,
of the Khazar.
Right. Plus the fact they are probably prone to about seven others, so they're prone to about 14 genetic diseases. So if they're not a race or a sub-race, they're probably at least a nationality, wouldn't you say?
Well, depending upon the Khazar influx into Germany, but the so-called German Jews were not all of Khazar
descent. Of course they weren't.
And so the question is, again, where do you define these Jews? So it was perfectly simple. The Jews who lived in Germany and defined themselves as Jews were, for all intents and purposes, considered to be Jews by the Germans. The French philosopher Renan said, a nation is a group of people which sees itself as a nation and who are seen by others as a nation. In this case, German Jews, who saw themselves primarily as Jews first and Germans second, were considered to be members of the Jewish nation. There was another class of Jews, however, who saw themselves as being loyal to Germany. They were Jews, but they were loyal to Germany. And so these were similar to allies. For example, many cynics or liars have pointed out that there were Indians, there were non-whites in the SS, that they were honorary Aryans. Well, this is not so. They were considered to be fellow nationals. And in Hitler's writing, in Mein Kampf, and in his second book, which is called Hitler's Secret Book, it was not published for obvious reasons, because by that time Hitler was in power. And he was actually carrying out the policies which he had described in that book. The people of color on planet Earth were considered to be people on their own footing, their own basis. And the one thing which Hitler did not want was race mixing, because race mixing is basically genocide.
Also, I'd like to bring out that during the time of Roosevelt and Hitler, you could not buy or sell gold in the United States, but in Nazi Germany, you could buy and sell all the gold that you could have, or you could buy possess. Also, that they had a stock market like the New York Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. They had one rather than two. And also point out that if you were a businessman, you could emerge to own quite a bit of property.
Yes, you could, provided you were productive. It's a big...
It was a meritocracy,
A meritocracy, yes. Mm-hmm. The thing to remember, though, was that Hitler believed that the stock exchange should have no power over the productive members of society. The stock exchange is similar to the economy the way Las Vegas or Atlantic City casinos are. They're speculative and they're redistributed, but they're not productive. And so Hitler said the producers should not be penalized on behalf of the speculators. This was another strong plank in the National Socialist Party platform, was that all productive labor would be rewarded and non-productive speculation, predation, which we call criminal behavior, naturally these people were taken out of society and made to work in labor camps. But the productive people, like the farmers and the factory workers and people who worked with their brain, were not going to be penalized because some speculator had driven up the price of the shares or had driven them down. So the stock market was much more controlled.
More stable, too.
Another thing was that Hitler did not allow speculation in the national currency.
Like they do in this country.
The national currency represents all your goods and services. Now, if I corral the national currency and I burn it up, you're going to experience a sudden ceasing in economic activity because there won't be any money, just like in the Great Depression. Now, Hitler knew this so well that to overcome the depression in Germany, Hitler had printed money without any backing, no gold, nothing like that. Gold is a commodity. Gold has its own value. Gold has no relation to productivity. Hitler's money was based on productivity. And since the Germans were productive people, they gave value to their money. It's not money that gives value to a ballpoint pen or any other good or service. It's the good and the service that gives value to the money. So Hitler knew this. This is a fundamental of National Socialism. And this caused the finance capitalists, the banksters, to go screaming up the wall. Germany had to be stopped. Unfortunately, these people, these gangsters, the biggest racket in the world is the creation of money by the banks like the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, the present-day Bank of the Bundesrepublik of Germany. This is the biggest racket in the world because these people are allowed by treasonous governments to create your money, my money, his money out of nothing. And for that, we pay these banksters interest.
True.
Now, isn't that something?
It's insanity.
When Hitler nationalized the Bank of Germany, which was a private bank, he stopped that. And that was another plus factor for National Socialism. Incidentally, Abraham Lincoln was printing similar money.
True.
It was money that was paid into existence for goods and services. It was not borrowed into existence the way present-day money is. And just before John F. Kennedy was assassinated, I noticed a peculiar thing. I noticed high denomination U.S. Treasury bills, notes, bank notes. It was called greenbacks, Abraham Lincoln currency in the United States. I've seen denominations up to $20. Previous to that, the $2 bill was your only U.S. note in circulation. And certain people said, oh, that's bad luck. It was bad luck for the Jewish finance gangsters. Sure it is, because they didn't get any interest on it. Now, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November 1963, I noticed that all these forms of U.S. currency vanished it all became Federal Reserve note, from the $1 bill on to the highest denomination. Sure. The $2 bill was changed, became a Federal Reserve note, right. And they put a black fellow in the Constitutional Convention. And even Time Magazine commented on that. Is somebody trying to rewrite our history? So the only people in this century who have used interest-free money have been Adolf Hitler and John F. Kennedy. Before him, Abraham Lincoln. So this is something to think about. National socialism encompasses many of the solutions to many of the problems which face us today. And to delude ourselves by putting the label of poison on something which will save our lives is stupidity of the lowest rank.
But you see, that's the problem we have today. The high school children and the young men and women in the colleges and universities have been so brain polluted, I call it, that it's very, very difficult to get to them and explain to them. They've been hoodwinked over the last 50, 60 years. So,
but the problem is, as an American who grew up believing in this idea of democracy, it gives us a tremendous amount of responsibility. Most people look at the freedoms you supposedly think you have.
True.
But to be a member of a democratic society imposes severe obligations on you. Number one, you have to be interested in the issues. Number two, you must inform yourself. It's not that you wait for somebody to tell you to be informed. You must inform yourself. Number three, you must take part in the governing of yourself. You mustn't say, oh yeah, well, politics is dirty. I have nothing to do with it, but I'll obey whoever the mucky-muck is in the White House, and if he wants to send our sons and daughters off to war, we'll go along with it without question. I can never understand that mentality.
Well, in about a minute and a half left, can you surmise what you would do to perhaps get the younger people interested into the system? Because it's so corrupt now, Eric. What would you do?
Well, we have to do is very simple, and what is simple is usually very difficult. What we have to do, we who have the ideas, have to get out the information. From the information comes the organization. From the organization, the action, and from the action, the realization of our ideas. And unless more people participate in the dissemination of ideas, the creation of the organization, we won't get off square one. And if we stay on square one, that will be the end of us.
Well, I think that you've said a lot of very important things here today, and I want to thank you for coming on the show. And did you want to just give the address to the people?
Please contact samizdat.publishers, 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, postal code M5A2L1, telephone area code 416-922-9850.
All right. Thank you very much, and tune in again for another Race and Reason, a ray of light in the sea of darkness. Thank you.